controversial. It's like, oh. That's what you
want. Good afternoon, everyone. We'll call the meeting of the Agriculture Rural Economies Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February 16th. First announcement for today is it's my mother's birthday. I want to wish her a happy birthday from afar. She may be dreaming about being here and enjoying the nice weather down in Arizona, so I want to wish my mom a happy birthday. But that leads into the next announcement we have, and today is our committee administrator's birthday. Aww. So how about a hand for our committee administrator?
We need a number.
My mom's 80. My mom's 80.
29. She's 29.
That's as far as I'm going to go with numbers today. Thanks, everyone. Mom's 80 today. And since I'm her favorite son, it would be not right that I didn't announce her birthday today. So, I am her only son. today's agenda, we do have a modification. We will not be doing Senate File 1635 today. We'll do this another day. We're in discussions with the stakeholders and the agencies and everyone else, and we're not quite ready to go with that one yet. So we'll delay that till another time. And again, another further announcements. I've talked to Senator Rosen. She has announced to an energy committee that a week from today we will be meeting in a joint energy agriculture meeting at the time frame energy meets at 3 o'clock. So if you can make that, that would be good. We're going to be talking about natural gas and energy issues here. We'll have national experts come in. Our concern has been that we put all our eggs in the natural gas basket, number one. But number two, if we are going to continue to see these extremely low prices for natural gas, we want to make sure we have the infrastructure, the pipelines, everything in place. And because we know how long it takes to get some of these things done, and we know how expensive this work is, so... it's just some concerns I've raised with Senator Rosen, and her and I have talked, and so she's agreed to do that. And so we'll have that meeting then, and those of you that can't make it, we'll get all the information for you that we can. So today we're going to talk about energy issues, and we'll start out the day with Senator Brown, who has Senate File 1534 up for our discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before us, like the Chair just said, Senate File 1534. This is a bill that will delay the effective date to eliminate certain limitations on wind easements. It's a very non-controversial bill, even for Senator Kelash. So it will protect the landowners against long-term easements. And you told me how to pronounce your name the Czech way, and I don't remember. But we do have two people here today to testify.
All right. Senator Brown. Senator Brown's moving Senate File 1534 to be passed and considered by the committee. So, Senator Brown, you're a testifier. So welcome, Representative, and a few NFO... And a few presidents, National Farmers Union President, our friend Doug Peterson, to the podium.
Thank you, Mr. Doug. Chairman, and I also greet the committee members, and also want to thank Senator Brown for introducing and advancing this, I think, fairly straightforward bill. Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Doug Peterson. I serve as president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'm here today to testify in strong support of Senate File 1534, authored by Senator Brown, and Minnesota Farmers Union appreciates the Senator for offering this very important legislation that simply extends the effective date to June 1st, 2017, for the use it or lose it provision in wind easements. Under the current law, a wind easement terminates if the easement does not begin commercial operations within 7 years. Minnesota Farmers Union successfully fought this legislation several years ago after concerns from our members had about signing 20, 50, and even perpetual year lease easements with energy companies, and then to have nothing happening, no development. Our members also had concerns about sourcing easements for smaller projects, and a lot of acres were locked up for long periods of time with no project in sight. Minnesota Farmers Union also had members encounter issues with their bankers regarding the length of some of these easements and some of the titles on these easements as they were applied to the land. This provision, we feel, has been working very well for both the law for the landowner and the wind developers, and we urge you to extend the sunset, which is what the legislation does. I thank you for your consideration, and I have with me a member from Le Sueur, Minnesota, Le Sueur County, Ryan Wolf, and he would also have some comments, if you might, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, President Peterson. And Mr. Wolf, when did you move?
Quite a while ago.
Okay.
It's been 6-7 years, something
okay.
like that. Yeah.
All right. But please state your name, yep. Ryan, and tell us about your situation.
Yep.
And
yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Ryan Wolf. I grew up in Mr. Magnus' district down there in southwestern Minnesota. I currently live in Le Sueur with my wife and kids. I am a community wind developer from Le Sueur. My family built a family wind project, like I said, down in the Senator's District there, based on the Minnesota FLIP model. After we concluded that project, we were approached by several of the landowners and other community members that wanted to try to replicate that success that we had for them. So we started a community wind developing company. And we've been working on a 57-megawatt project ever since. We also support this bill. We think it works very good for the landowners, and it works for the for us as wind developers also. And certainly feel happy to answer any questions that any of you may have.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and probably for former Representative Peterson. I support this use it or lose it extension, but I have a question. You talked about the wind easements. What happens if somebody signs a perpetual easement, they build the wind turbine? Well, perpetual is a lot longer than the life of the wind turbine. So what happens when the wind turbine wears out? Does it then again go away after a number of years, or what happens there?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scoy,
President Peterson.
My anticipation, and I'm going to have our wind expert actually answer that. I'm anticipating that in the contract of that lease or easement, there would be a insurance piece on the turbine, because I don't think anybody's going to be able to get loans without insurances on this turbine and the megawatt and efficiency. But that's as deep as I am. Now I'm going to turn, if I might, Mr. Chairman, over to Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Usually what you have is an option period that takes place, so we go to a landowner, we signed an easement which contains an option period, and that option period gives us, up to the 7 years to build the wind farm. After the wind farm is built, I don't think that this legislation necessarily applies, does it? Because this is identifying that the project has to be built within 7 years, is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's not my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My question is, what happens? The wind farm is built, turbine's up there. 40 years from now, my crystal ball is cloudy. I don't know how yours is. But what happens when the wind turbines are no longer functioning or economical? Is there still a wind easement that stays on that land, or what happens?
Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, usually the contract contains provisions that as long as the turbine is on the piece of property, the rent must be paid. So as long as the turbine is there, under most circumstances, even if it's not producing energy, the renter is obligated to pay the rent for the turbine, and then. These are long-term leases, so like you said, 40 years from now, the turbine is, that original turbine is probably not going to be still functioning. So usually what will happen is there will be some sort of a refurbishing period or a replacement period, and then that would continue to operate and the rent would continue to be paid. If the renter, the turbine owner, decided that they were going to take it down, usually that terminates the lease, and there's provisions in the contract for returning the land to the original state.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy, if you look at the analysis here, Senate Council's put together, in these contracts vary virtually between every land owner that has these. Some contracts are upfront money. Some are royalty on the production produced. Some of them are over a period of years, so they vary with each contract. But I've asked Senate Council to look this up because I wanted to see what Section 500.2 had to say, and because we do say that here and here some relation to that. So, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, as the chairman mentioned, if you look at the language that's in there now, there aren't any line numbers, if you look in the middle, it starts, shall be unenforceable on account of lack of privity of estate or privity of contract. Such easements shall run with the land or lands benefited and burdened and shall constitute a perpetual easement, except that an easement may terminate upon the condition stated therein. That would be in the easement itself. So the easement itself could have conditions that limited the time period, or pursuant to the provisions of 500.20. And 500.20 deals with defeasible estates. And this is not an area that I'm extremely familiar with, but I can tell you that in subdivision 2A, it does talk about a 30-year, that they would cease to be valid and operative 30 years from the date of the deed or other instrument. So there could be a way under that also where they could be made inoperative. But I've not seen one of these easements, but I'm guessing that these easements would have a date in there, or at least some conditions that if it's not operating, that the easement would go away. Hopefully people are doing that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Very good question, Senator Scoy. Very good. Because I don't know that either. I've got thousands of them out there in our area, but I don't know that either. So, good question. Okay. Any further questions for testifiers? Do we have anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate File 1534? Seeing none, Senator Brown, we'll send this, I think, on to the Energy Committee. Senator Rosen would like to look at it. And so our motion will be that we send Senate File 1534 to the Energy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion carries. Thank you very much for testifying,
Thank
gentlemen.
You. Thank you. Yep.
Next we have Mr. Robert Ryan come up and talk to us today.
Difficult.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ryan. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is Robert Ryan. I'm the chair and president of European Energy Connections, which is a company that's based out of Rhode Island, Minnesota, and has a branch office in Stockholm, Sweden. Sophia Rettler operates our office in Stockholm. Myself and my wife, Mary, operate the Minnesota model. And, Mr. Chair, first of all, I'd like to thank Senator Kubley for asking me to come before the committee and testify about our operations and what we have achieved in Senator Kubley's district. I'm sorry. Is that helpful?
There, that's better. Thank you.
So, basically, as I said, what we do is we basically provide a service of transferring renewable energy technology from Europe to the United States. We do the technology that we transfer is intellectual property. We do not believe in moving finished goods from any place else in the world here, but we believe that we have excellent manufacturing facilities here in Minnesota and other areas of the U.S. to actually build these systems to be utilized by our U.S. consumers. So the way we do this is we, or Sophia and her team in Stockholm, actually look to find these advanced technologies in mostly the Scandinavian theater. It seems like that is the kind of the mecca of what's moving forward in the industry today. And she basically approaches these firms to see if they're interested in doing business in the U.S. Mary and I work to find manufacturers and distribution networks that are interested in advancing their technology and expanding their catalogs to these new technologies. We both collect and build databases of these companies and match them appropriately when we have willing companies from both from wherever to U.S. manufacturing and distribution networks. Once these companies are matched, we put together foundation documents that help to speed up the process in providing the companies a working relationship to make sure that it feels good to them. And once that's established, we start to put together draft documents such as letters of intent, manufacturing contracts, and basically distribution agreements. Once we've put together the letter of intent and those front-end documents, we then move those towards the legal team so they develop that system. We are not lawyers. We are consultants. And what we want to do is just speed up the process and being able to make these programs happen a little quicker. Once that's completed, we finish the advanced documents through the licensing agreements and royalty systems, along with some particular projects that are just plain contracted and purchased. After the system is in place, we monitor the sales of those products, do consumer satisfaction of those products, and then also track sales and make sure that the technology company is receiving royalties, if that's in case what they're doing. Why do we do this? Well, we believe in U.S. manufacturing. We believe in U.S. distribution networks, and we believe that the products need to be built here in the U.S. if they're going to be sold here in the U.S. And the reason for that is standards are different in Europe than they are here. Measurement systems and standards of safety are different between the continents, and it's just a much cleaner process to be able to do that, Mr. Chair. We believe in the development of rural communities, and we believe that rural communities have the abilities to develop these industries without any issue at all. Biomass. What is biomass? Basically, biomass is nothing more than the stored energy from the sun, and they come from multiple different types of fuel ingredients and along with the wind systems that are created by our weather, the sun directly inputting into solar systems and in the biosystems, everything from corn stalks to corn cobs, secondary wood waste to whole standing trees to ag ingredients such as corn or sunflower hulls and soybean straw. I'm using soybean straw because I live in Renville County in Senator Kubley's district, and we in western Minnesota produce a lot of corn and soybeans. And soybean straw was one of the products that we thought we could take and look to as a potential fuel source because of the good combustion capabilities of the soybean stock. We do not use the leaves, the pedicles, or the pods themselves, only the stem. And it produces a very high thermal value at a very low ash rate. So these products, they add revenue for farmers. They basically provide this product with no additional input costs. It take very little soil nutrition out of the equation because stem itself is extremely low in fertility values, only like $2.73 an acre if we take 1 ton per acre off the field. If we go in the southern half of the state of Minnesota and put a pin in the map almost any place and draw a circle in a 30-mile radius, we'll find that we can extract approximately 300,000 ton of soybean straw at these agronomic rates of being only 42% of the plant off these fields and use this product as an excellent fuel source. A ton of soybean straw has got the same thermal value as 176 gallons of LP gas. If you take that 176 gallons, the value, and take it times 300 ton of material, you can see that we have generated the equivalence of 52,500,000 gallons of LP gas in each one of those 30-mile rings. That equates to, in today's prices, at approximately $2 a gallon, $105 million worth of revenue that is put back into those communities. And I think that's a real plus for any community. We have picture to the left.
Excuse me, Mr. Ryan. Senator Scoy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you leave the soybean, how do you get the straw? I mean, when you run the soybean through the combine, what comes out the back is pretty
dusty.
What
we've done in our...
Mr. Ryan?
Excuse me. Yep.
That's okay. You...
Chair?
Yep. He'll ask me the question, and then you ask me back, and then I go to him, and that way we kind of have some... order in the house here, so, and it keeps me
involved. Excuse
me,
Mr. Chair.
That's okay. Don't worry
Mr.
about
Chair.
It. We're fine.
Senator, yep. The process, how that is done is in the older conventional combines, we basically take the chopper off the back and drop the straw in a windrow and off the rotary systems and basically pull the knives back and just drop the straw directly on the ground and picked up with a round baler. This is the basis that we have done in our manufacturing.
And it bales.
Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
And it bales. I mean, you can actually get it to work in one of those belt balers.
Yeah. Absolutely. The bales that you're looking at in this particular slide are soybean straw bales.
Senator Kelash.
Yeah, maybe I'm getting ahead of you a little bit, but the equation of LP gas to tons of straw, there's LP gas, you can put it in a machine, and what's the actual fuel source, and is it equivalent as far as usage goes?
I think Mr. Chair.
Ryan?
I believe it would be easier to wait until we get a little further into the
presentation. Okay, thanks.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ryan, I'm not sure if this is a part of your presentation, but and we can talk offline if it's not, but I'm just quite interested. I've not seen anything like this hybrid willow before, and I'm curious, one, can it be grown in Minnesota? And two, do we need to have certain types of machines then to harvest it? Is it a whole new type of crop that needs a whole new line of machines?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ryan.
Madam Senator. As I proceed in the presentation, I think that this may be also...
Okay. Thank you.
As
it's
we
like
move
you're
forward,
using just a silage chopper. But
But basically, what you're looking at... I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Senator...
No, that's all right.
What we're looking at in this slide is a product called Solex, which is a hybrid willow that's been developed in Sweden. And this is my partner's... Sophia's father harvesting bioenergy crops called Solex, which is being chopped with a conventional cloth forge chopper and hauled to Uppsala to their district energy facility where they develop electricity and heat for 90,000 people based solely on the use of this particular product. It's harvested every other year. It grows approximately 7 feet a year and will generate anywhere from 9 to 11 ton per hectare. So it is, there again, it is one source, one type. It can be produced here. The growing season is actually a little longer here than where Uppsala is. So we would definitely be able to look at that as a potential energy crop here in the U.S.
Okay. Senator Kubley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ryan, what was the pelletized fuel source made of at the Murdoch School? You mentioned the low waste of soybean straw, and I know their waste was very low.
Yeah. Mr. Ryan, he's asking about the waste out of your facility in the Murdoch School. And you mentioned earlier in your presentation that the ash waste and so on is very low out of using soybean straw. So he's asking you to explain that a little further and give a little more detail about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley. The Murdoch School system is a boiler that basically is burning at this point wood pellets, and the wood pellets that are consumed within that boiler generate only 1% ash. We burned a little over 35 ton wood pellets in that boiler 1 year ago, and we generated about a 30-gallon trash can full of ash throughout that year. So it's extremely low ash content after the combustion process, and of course the residue makes a great fertility for agronomic products.
Okay,
so, Mr. Chair, I think if I could proceed and finish. Okay.
Senator Benson has a question. Do you want to ask it now, Senator? Or you want to?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, please. We'll go on. So.
Thank
ahead,
you, Mr.
Senator.
Chair. And Mr. Ryan, thanks for coming today. Actually, Murdoch was my elementary school, so now I'll have something to ask about when I go home this weekend. I was wondering about this hybrid willow. Can it be grown on marginal soils? I worry a little bit about food crop displacement for energy crops. And so if you could help me out in understanding what kind of soils this might grow in.
Mr. Ryan?
Mr. Chair. This particular product, in where it's being harvested now, is in lower marginal production land. Sven is Sophia's father's name. He grows this product in the wetter areas of his farm, and he harvests it in the late fall and early winter when the ground is somewhat froze. So, yes.
Senator, that piqued Senator Scoy's interest, Mr. Ryan. So,
well, does he replant it? I mean, the willows that I'm familiar with will just keep growing and growing and growing. Is that the way this is?
This cutting that you're seeing now, excuse me.
Go ahead, Mr. Ryan. Nope, we're right.
Cutting that you're seeing now is the seventh cutting, so it's been the 14 years since that plant was planted, and it regrows, and there are people that have that 14 cuttings.
You know, the other thing, Mr. Chair,
that's a good question. Yeah.
I like this idea of having something to harvest in November so I can kind of harvest year-round.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this because this fits the legislative schedule now for a farmer. You don't have to plant, you know. You sit here in the end of April and early May, I get kind of antsy about getting home and getting my crops planted. And if I only have to do that every other year, then we could only meet every other year, and then we could harvest it, and, geez, we'd be in the willow, I'll tell you that.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Ryan.
Chair, you'd have to work after Thanksgiving.
Good question. Yep.
Going on to the presentation.
Yes.
Solex is a wonderful opportunity and a great biomass crop for energy crop in Europe. This particular slide, I'm going to go through a series of slides of an ag school that's much like our University of Minnesota Crookston, where it's an ag community school, and they use a lot of different resources related to the ag community. This particular red building, if you look in the background, you'll see a direct-drive wind turbine that's producing electricity into the system that's producing electricity for the school system. On the top of the red building, you're seeing on the backside of that is a set of solar thermal panels that is producing water for their domestic water. The back of the building stands a silo that is where they're storing their wood pelleted fuel, which is being transported into this Italian-made D'Alessandro boiler. This boiler is made and constructed to be able to burn a variety of different fuels again. The control system is a highly advanced system out of Sweden, which can achieve up to a 92 to 94% thermal efficiency on the production of hot water. Not only do they use those systems as energy producers within their school system, they also have a mini turbine that's driven through this small creek that's barely 8 feet wide and runs at about 18 inches of water. It runs year-round but generates 250 kilowatts of power, 300 every day of every year, 24 hours a day. Direct drive wind systems have become the norm in most of the Scandinavian countries now because of their efficiency factor. This particular unit, if you look at the nacelle, is extremely small. It produces out of the same volume 28 to 32% more energy than the traditional wind systems that we see here in the U.S. Motorless and transportable MSW through RDF plants are a norm all over all of Europe. There are no landfills in Europe. All of their household waste is combusted. As in Europe, as we are here in the U.S., we generate more waste in the summer than we do in the winter. So they bale it in airtight bales where it's sealed and used and consumed in the winter. There's literally odorless, and when the bales are opened in the winter, they look just exactly like they did when they were put in the summer. Also, city municipal waste and animal agriculture waste generating hydrogen, or generating methane gas is pushed into biogas refining systems, cleaned and pressurized, put into transportation systems where it can be transported to gas filling stations along with your ethanol, gasoline, diesel fuel, and whatever, to be fueled, fuel systems that directly hook into the car that fuel vehicles like this Ford Taurus, which is manufactured in Detroit, Michigan, and shipped to Scandinavia and sold through the Volvo system. These are all products that we generate out in the prairie, in the farm communities, that we could utilize these systems like this today. While we're doing it here as well, we're making great strides, and I want to thank the great policy work that you and the people before you have presented for this state. This particular facility is Prairie Woods Environmental Learning Center, which is located just out of New London, Minnesota, which is north of Wilmer. As you look at this slide, the building off to the left has got a passive solar system, which basically looks like the facade of the building has just got a different design. But that is a solar system that heats that 30-foot climbing wall that those kids climb inside of that building on a daily basis. And this will generate room temperatures of 50 to 60 degrees when it's 30 below outside. To the building to the right and on the roof slope on the left side of that building, you can see solar photovoltaic and solar thermal panels that are generating electricity into the grid and also domestic hot water for that facility. In the background, you can just barely see possibly the back here is a 20 kilowatt Jacobson turbine, which now over a year generates more electricity than the facility uses. And the facility is very proud to say that they have achieved 100% renewable energy production in their facility, which means they cannot go offline, but they are able to provide more electricity than they consume. The fuels that are used is 100% biomass fuels, and that their solar systems provide them with both additional electricity and hot water. Again, if you look at your attention to the slide, you see that there's a silo to the right side, which is generating the fuels for the boiler on the left side of your slide, which is a D'Alessandro boiler. Now, if you remember, this is the same company of the boiler that we saw in the ag school in Sweden. I'm very proud to say that our company has now made arrangements with the D'Alessandro company, the Abionova company, which is the electronics control company, and a company in Red Lake Falls, Minnesota called Northwest Manufacturing, who now is manufacturing this commercial boiler here in the U.S. Those boilers range from the very smallest, which you're looking at, 300,000 BTUs, to 8.2 million BTUs. They've installed several of their new systems now in Minnesota. We just finished a project at Wolf's Bridge Environmental Learning Center in Finland, north of Duluth. And the St. Louis County School System is installing two boilers, along with several in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Picture to the right is the very thing that's interested Senator Kubley and brought me here today. This school is in the Murdoch community, the Kirkhoven-Murdoch-Sundberg, or KMS, school district, installed this boiler, which is manufactured in Canada. It's Arbor, Canada, which is north of Winnipeg. The technology was Austrian. It, too, can burn coal, corn, biomass pellets, or wood pellets. The school district bought this boiler to burn corn. Installed it a year and a half ago, and intended to for the local farmers that send their kids to that district to provide the fuel source for their school. As you all know, the agricultural community has done very well. You can't buy corn for $4 a bushel anymore, which made it work. Mm-hmm. We are now using wood pellets because it's much more cost effective than the systems that. Than burning corn as of now. Matter of fact, this school heats the rest of their complex with fuel oil, and I need to back up a little bit. This does not heat the entire building. It heats only the gymnasium, but it is online to add to be able to provide more heat within the building. If we look at the comparisons of fuel costs today, they are buying wood pellets for $180 a ton. That computes to an equal cost of $1.55 in number two fuel oil today, or $1.01 a gallon propane costs, or natural gas costs at $1.13 a therm. So these systems are very cost effective. It definitely is the best advantage of utilizing these systems is in communities that do not have the luxury of having natural gas at their disposal, but they will cash flow in natural gas as well. So,
Senator Kelaz, excuse me a second.
Mr. Chair, just to this system, what are we talking about as far as premium pricing for the system itself or for the operation of it, maintenance, whatever else you can add to, in comparison to, say, a standard boiler system?
Mr. Ryan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The systems that we are looking at are fully automated systems. They're totally automatic. If you look at the picture of the small boiler at the Prairie Woods Environmental Learning Center, you'll see that there are motors on either side of that unit. Those are for ash and soot extraction. The boiler cleans itself. The blue motor on the bottom to the right is the fuel feed system, which runs on a frequency drive system that the control system itself operates and controls both the fuel, the air mixture on a constant basis and also measures the stack gas, its temperature, and its emissions factor as well. These boilers burn at EPA 2 standards. They're extremely clean burning and do not, this particular size does not require an afterburning system for cleaning or scrubbing. The 4 million BTU systems that were installed in Wolf's Ridge, they do have cyclone systems that offer additional cleaning capability. That particular system is a little more advanced, but it is no more advanced than a fuel oil boiler that would be a new fuel oil boiler or a new gas boiler today.
And just
okay, Senator,
Mr. Kelaz. Just the cost comparison for install?
Ryan? The cost comparison as far as they are comparable in cost to if you were replacing the system with another coal system. They are going to be a higher price than a LP gas system and higher than a fuel oil system. But, of course, we're looking at half the cost of the fuel sources.
Thank you. All right. Continue on, Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's look at the fuel sectors of the renewable fuel sectors of the in the U.S. consist of three major components: transportation, which contributes to 27% of the total energy consumed in our nation today. We here in Minnesota, I think there again, your policy and the ability to construct the ethanol and biodiesel systems that we have here today, I believe we still lead the nation in the number of fueling systems in our state, and I think we're doing a great job with that. But it is only 27% of the total needs. Industry, our power companies, and large, super large users are adapting to and are in incorporating mostly wind in this part of the U.S. Deep magma geothermal systems are being utilized where that systems exist, and we are doing quite a good job in trying to bring down some of those uses of fossil fuels in the industrial site. But by far the largest consumer of energy in the U.S. is not transportation or industry. It's heating and cooling homes. Businesses, churches, capitals, those are that's the place where energy is utilized. And quite frankly, we haven't really approached it here in this country. We hear a lot of issues related to wind and power and in the development of new transportation fuels, but we have not addressed. So you heard me talk an awful lot about Sweden, and the reason I do is Sweden does lead the nation, or the world, excuse me, in the development of biomass systems. Over the last 20 years, from 1990 until chart only goes out to 2009, but they have been able to increase the use of their bioenergy products. That's everything from hydrogen production to geothermal to biomass to all facets of renewable energy by 80%. They've also been able to reduce their carbon footprint by 9%, which is a very, very important to the Scandinavian people. But the thing that impresses me more and a lot, most people in the U.S. is the center black line. They've raised their gross national product by 48% based upon renewable energy. That's real money. And I constantly hear how we as a community cannot afford to put any money into renewable energy because we can't afford it. These systems are very, very profitable. Provide great opportunities for our communities.
Okay.
So, in wrapping up, I think I want to try to instill in you is that the development of new types of biofuel refineries, such as solid fuels and gasification systems, have real potential here in Minnesota and in the U.S. The largest sector of energy consumption is not transportation. It's homes. It's heating buildings. And we need to start taking that into account. We don't have to spend 20 years in R&D because these systems exist in other places in the world. We just have to encourage the process of developing them here. But they must be made here. The potential for renewable energy manufacturing is huge for rural Minnesota, and that's not only manufacturing boilers in Red Lake Falls. That's manufacturing fuels wherever. The potential of the rural community of becoming a much bigger player in the production of energy, I believe, is a great opportunity for us. And this would provide an opportunity to repopulate a really depressed western half of the state of Minnesota and repopulate our communities. And with that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Senator Kubley has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ryan, do you remember what the Murdoch School achieved in actual cost savings just heating their gym? It seems, Tom, it was quite significant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, a year ago we computed the difference between the fuel oil that they would have needed to heat that, the square footage of that gym's footprint, and we saved about $6,820. The total cost of that project ran a little over $86,000. We are just barely idling that system. We need to be able to expand the footprint of utilizing that heating system within that school district, and I'm sure that we can cut their heating cost in half.
Okay. Senator Scoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ryan. I'm struck by the graph of the buildings being half of the energy. I start thinking about my own energy usages, and I mean, I know that the cost of the heating of our house isn't anywhere near what our gas bill to drive around is. So what is that on? Is that dollars or energy units? Or, I mean, what kind of information is that that gives a half of the energy usage in the country to heating and cooling buildings?
Mr. Ryan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, this graph was a graph that I received from the Department of Energy in the comparison of total energy use for these particular sectors, including electricity. When you look at heating your home and your home only, comparatively to heating this community of Minneapolis and St. Paul and all the other sectors of the community, including buildings, schools, courthouses, hospitals, and everything related to it, these are facts that come from the Department of Energy.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Ryan,
Senator Scoy,
it's probably based on energy units then, and not dollars. Is that what I'm getting it around? Or
it's Mr. total energy Ryan? Dollars.
Energy,
Mr. Chair.
Energy dollars. Wow. Wow.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ryan, and thank you, Senator Kubley, for suggesting to have you come in. And we've been talking about this for over a year, and when he talked about to me about what's going on at the Murdoch School and some of the things you're doing. Senator Rosen, the energy chairman.
Yeah, I do have a couple questions, if you don't mind.
Go
Mr.
ahead.
Mr. Ryan, your contained waste product that you put into the bundles, what are those used for? Is that for energy for households and businesses, or how are they combusted?
Mr. Ryan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, those contained units of MSW are used in large boilers to create electricity and hot water for communities, district energy systems, so like power utilities.
Okay,
Senator Chair, Rosen.
Thank you. And Mr. Ryan, is there any technology that you see or you would like to see some focus on in the states that the European communities have embraced that you see a real potential here?
Mr. Ryan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I see so much potential. It's absolutely amazing what we could be looking at doing here, and I firmly believe that these things will all eventually move their way here based upon the reality of what energy and energy costs will be. What I see the policymakers positioned to be is to make these opportunities available in whatever way they can, because we need jobs. Jobs is our issues here, and this whole industry is job wealthy. I mean, it provides manufacturing, distribution, service, transportation, and a whole array of deliverable services that is brand new. Everything else that we try to add to in our industry sector that exists today, we're stealing from someplace else. This is all new. All new. It will bring a total new industry into existence. So if I can be of any help, Mr. Chair, in any way of bringing information and trying to assist in the development of policy, I would more than gladly
right. Thank you.
And I thank, again, Senator Kubley and the committee for hearing me today.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Ryan, would you make an appointment, come to the office sometime and speak?
I'd love to, ma'am.
Yeah, we need to talk. We have the Renewable Development Fund informational hearing today on that fund. It's in an energy at 3 o'clock, but at some point, we'd sure like to talk to you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. And this kind of leads us into the next presentation we have scheduled today, and that's on the Next Generation Energy Board. Some of us serve on that. That's been going for a few years now. And so I've asked the department, Greta Gauthier is here, with the Department of Ag to give us an update on what's going on with the Next Generation Energy Board. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greta Gauthier. I'm with the Department of Agriculture. And I'm here today to give you a brief update on the Next Gen Energy Board, which is the board that is looking at the next generation of energy sources for our state. This board, just as a little refresher, has 20 members. They come from both, well, from government, from the private sector, from higher education. The chairs of the House and Senate Ag and Energy Committees, the Departments of Agriculture and DEED, DNR, PCA, and Commerce. We also have some folks from the University of Minnesota and from the MinSCU system sitting on the Next Gen Energy Board, the Farmers Union and the Farm Bureau, and also we have some private sector groups like Minnesota Forest Industries, the Great Plains Institute, and the Nature Conservancy. So it's a diverse group of people with various expertise that they bring to the table. This year, as you know, there was $2.4 million that was appropriated last session as part of the Department of Agriculture's budget bill that was going to be sent out in grants under the Next Gen Energy Board. So many of the new board members were appointed in the spring of last year. They had their first meeting in June of last year. In August, the board determined the criteria by which they wanted to address or by evaluate the projects that would come before them. And in September, our department, which staffs the Next Gen Board, because the Commissioner of Agriculture is the chair, we issued an RFP and posted it in the state register. We put it on our website, and everybody on the Next Gen Board spread it to every place they knew to spread far and wide. So we hope we had good outreach. The proposals were due in early November, and we received a total of 18 eligible proposals. The next step was the technical team. The Next Gen technical team is comprised of bioenergy specialists from the five departments of state government that sit on the Next Gen Energy Board. Those are, again, Agriculture, DNR, DEED, PCA, and Commerce. They reviewed and scored all the proposals independently over a two-week period, and then they met for two half days, to discuss every single proposal and determine their ranking for all of the proposals. And then in early December, the technical team presented its findings to the Next Gen Board. And after examination of their recommendations and discussion, the board recommended a package of grant awardees and amounts to Commissioner Fredrickson of the Department of Ag. The Next Gen Board operates a little differently than legislative committees that do granting, because in the executive branch, granting entities are subject to the data practices law. So none of the information about the grantees is final until we have a signed contract between the state and the grantee. It's a little bit different where in some of the legislative committees like CCMR or Lessard-Sams, et cetera, you would be seeing the proposals as they are arriving for consideration. In the executive branch, we cannot divulge information until we have a signed contract. The good news is the commissioner is reviewing the last of those contracts actually today and tomorrow, and we hope to have all of them signed and a report out in about a week for you. But I can tell you generally that the 9 projects that were funded deal with biomass gasification. There are 2 that deal with anaerobic digestion, 2 that are biomass to energy, 1 that is biomass to ammonia, which of course is fertilizer, 1 on-farm biodiesel project, continuation of an oil seed crop development project, and a second generation ethanol project. And they're spread pretty evenly, I think, around the state. The projects are in Shakopee, Wilmer, Medelia, Williams, Staples, Bruton, Claremont, Isanti, and Olivia. And if anybody can show me where all of those are in the map, you're doing good. So we also had a presentation this fall from some biogas experts, and so the board was able to learn some more about that industry, what the current trends are, et cetera. And the board is not planning to meet again now until after the legislative session. Traditionally, the board has not met during session because so many of the members are several of the members are legislators. So I apologize for not having a paper report to put in front of you today, but we're very close to that point, and as soon as we are, we'll get something to each and every one of you. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can. Mr. Chairman, I also have other staff from the department should there be detailed questions. Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman.
All right, any questions of Ms. Gauthier? I just thought we'd do an energy day today and thought it would be nice to have an update to what's going on. I can report a couple things in the epicenter of renewable energy, southwestern Minnesota. The Gevo plant for biobutanol is in progress. We have 200 construction workers down there now with some big cranes retrofitting one of our smaller ethanol plants into the first commercial biobutanol plant in the world. Senator Dames's district will be another ethanol or biobutanol retrofit from an ethanol plant. So the next generation of things is coming along, and we've had some good discussion today, and so we've got some exciting times in front of us, and I look forward to those. I think it'll be a lot of fun. So with that, seeing nothing else for today, we will adjourn the meeting of the Committee on Agriculture and Rural Economies. Thank you, everyone, for participation.
Uncalled.